You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
For starters, it is long past time for the Saudis, the Qataris and the Kuwaitis and others to stop their citizens from funding extremist organizations.
Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton directly links Arab countries to terrorism. My guests, Alessio Patilano and Sir William Patey, will be discussing how the US's allies in the Middle East will react. Also... the new breed of football hooligans, the Russians. We'll be looking at the cultures that breed off-pitch violence and why both England and Russia are the troublemakers. All that, plus as Donald Trump bans the Washington Post from his election events, we'll ask, can he really do without the press? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Sir William Patey, former British ambassador to Afghanistan, Sudan, Iraq and Saudi Arabia, and Dr. Alessio Patilano, senior lecturer at King's College London. Welcome both to the programme. Now, vigils, marches and rallies have been held across the world to remember the victims of the deadly attack in Orlando. 49 people were killed when a gunman attacked a gay nightclub in the city in the early hours of Sunday. So William, what's been intriguing is, I guess, as the story has unfolded today, we've kind of discovered that maybe this man was attending the nightclub, maybe he was kind of using gay dating sites. So it becomes less of a kind of the story we thought it was 2 years ago. Do you think that in some way explains the security failings? This wasn't a lone wolf terrorist. This was potentially more a bipolar man who was slightly crazy and, you know, who managed to get some arms at the very last minute. Do you still think it is a security failure in that sense?
I'm not sure even if there weren't more complicated motives that you could call it a security failing, because there is no defence against a lone wolf who wakes up one day, who's been on the radar of intelligence agencies, but hasn't actually been actively involved in trying to organise a terror attack, decides that they're going to go on the rampage. And I suppose the difference between the United States and elsewhere, I mean, see, in Paris, we've had an attack with someone with stabbing. Whereas in the United States, he was able to get a hold of an automatic weapon. And I think that's the difference. It's the availability of, in a civilian context, a weapon of mass destruction, frankly, an AK-15. So I think whether it was a hate crime, somebody who was, you know, tied up in his own confused sexuality, or somebody who was radicalised, there's not much the intelligence agencies can do to predict this sort of event.
Alessio, maybe jumping back to the question we were talking about with Sir William, the security side, you know, that's your speciality. When you look at this story, do you feel the same thing, that it maybe isn't the kind of security story we initially thought it was?
I couldn't agree more. I don't think this is a security failure. We live in an age where one of the challenges that we have to grasp and we have to live with is this exact very scenario. You've got a person that, for whatever personal reasons, radicalizes, and society, for as much as one tries, cannot reach out to him or her, and therefore turns into a weapon and against the society where that nurture him or her in the first place. So I think from this point of view, there's very few things you can do. I think, however, the most important element that is emerging from this atrocity, from this drama, is the very interesting reaction, as if societies in the Western world, in the United States certainly, but I think in Europe as well, we are sort of starting to learn accustomed to the fact that this could happen, but we cannot let something like this, some sort of unravel our way of living. thing. It's something that you have to accept somehow and trust the institution that are looking after and try to sort of increase the security to a point that these are the exceptions rather than something that in regular occurrence. So bringing terrorism as a strategic challenge rather than a tactical problem, you know, the kind of thing that would happen regularly. We're not there because I think, you know, when something like this happened, we knew about it because the effects are so clear in front of our eyes, but we don't know of all the relentless effort of the security services on a daily basis to prevent many other things like that from happening.
But as we were saying, even though they had interviewed him on several occasions, you know, if they had kind of checked his profile, they may have seen a gentleman who was going to gay clubs, who was, you know, he seemed to be, he was drinking apparently, all sorts of things. He would not have fitted the profile of somebody that they would have leapt on anyway. So
even if he had, there's not much they could do about it. Mm. The Americans have a sort of a legal premise of probable cause. You need to actually tap his phone or to intercept anything. They'd need more than they had to go further. And frankly, there are quite a lot of people, I mean, hundreds of people who would have fit his profile, who you can't go and arrest, detain on the basis, nor can you watch over them 24 hours a day. I suppose the reasonable point that President Obama made is, but if you're on a no-fly list, and they have been vetted by FBI, you probably could tell them that they're not allowed to buy automatic weapons with multiple ammunition. That might be something you could do that would help.
And I think this is one of the key points that draws a difference, because what we're talking about is someone, you know, the atrocity itself is the scale. Why that scale was possible because of the type of weapon that the person had access to. And so this wouldn't happen regularly in Europe, where we have a certain degree of restriction, unless you get in on a black market, but at which point it would be more reasonable to suspect there was some sort of security failure, because how is that possible that someone that is familiar with that kind of underground context was not on your list? So, but here what we're looking at is a general attitude. You know, the Fifth Amendment, we all know what it means to the Americans, and in a way it's what allowed for this tragedy to amplify itself to the point and reach the stage it did.
So what's interesting, I guess, when you see these tragedies unfold on both sides of the Atlantic, when the Americans normally comment on what's happened in Europe, they feel it's a failure of kind of community relations, a failure to kind of know what's going on in communities. And normally when we look across to America, we blame gun culture, we blame the easy access to guns. But this time it does seem a community failure as well. You know, I wonder whether the roots go deep enough into the Afghan diaspora. You know, you've been in Afghanistan, you know Afghan people who have come to the West. What do you feel about the nature of the Afghan community? Because we've seen his father's comments as well, saying, you know, God will be the judge of these people. He's a man who's been on Afghan TV. He's a supporter of the Taliban. Well, how disparate or how unified is the Afghan diaspora, do you think?
Well, not very unified. The first thing that came to my mind when I heard about this young Afghan who'd been born in New York and lived his whole life in the United States, I contrasted where he'd ended up with a good friend of mine who was the US ambassador in Iraq, an Afghan who'd left Afghanistan age 16 and had come to the United States and been given an opportunity and had risen to be the US ambassador to Iraq and Afghanistan. So there are different trajectories. I mean, it's not as if this young man was traumatized by Afghanistan. He grew up in the United States, and, you know, he would have had all the opportunities of others. So I don't think you can generalize about this, the fact that he was an Afghan. He may have been attracted to websites and to stories about the Taliban. Who knows? But I think for every Afghan who's taken a gun and become a terrorist, I can point to 10 Afghans who are really well integrated citizens.
And over time, he seems to have claimed support for like every group going, even groups who hate each other. He was supporting Al Qaeda, Hezbollah, you name it. He'd given it his support over time.
Exactly. I was about to say, I mean, when there's a very good article in New York Times that is giving us a little bit more of background about specifically all the various sort of support that he expressed to different type of groups, and you can read into that some sort of schizophrenia. It's like, you know, there's nothing to do with Afghanistan. It could have been any sort of allegiance. It just spoke to his own persona, to his own individual, sort of to what he thought was a response, you know, an answer to all sorts of problems that he might have had. To what extent that's a community failure? Probably, but in terms of every single, you know, as much as me or you having a personal problem, we and society, the community around us, does not help us to try to address it in a way, because there's nothing from the information that we have at the moment that would classify this as some sort of alienation of a particular community that is.
But also, the strange thing is, you know, that sometimes it seems to be what you talk about integration, and it's you feel that some of the people get involved in these attacks. You know, they have no integration to society at all, and then other people like this. You know, he had a full time job. Mm. You know, he spoke fluent English. He knew the culture, so there'd been a level of integration. The community failure isn't one of cohesion there or integration. It's a more complex issue. But we're going to stay in the US now because Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump delivered contrasting speeches on counterterrorism yesterday as the two presidential candidates responded to the weekend's massacre in Orlando. There was one part in Hillary Clinton's speech that may have grabbed attention, though, at some embassies in the US. Let's have a listen.
For starters, it is long past time for the Saudis, the Qataris and the Kuwaitis and others to stop their citizens from funding extremist organizations. And they should stop supporting radical schools and mosques around the world that have set too many young people on a path toward extremism.
So, William, how will that have gone down on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I don't think they'd be very pleased. It happens to coincide with Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's visit to the United States. I think we can put this down to an election and that Hillary Clinton's opponent is Donald Trump, who's going to build walls and ban Muslims. So how do you kind of outflank him? Not easily on this subject. So I think she wouldn't have said this speech if she was Secretary of State and not a presidential candidate against Donald Trump. I think the reality is, I mean, I was ambassador in Saudi Arabia till 2010. The Saudis themselves were trying to clamp down on all sorts of funding that was going to Al-Qaeda, and they will certainly be doing the same with Daesh or ISIL, because the Al-Qaeda and Daesh represent an existential threat to them. So they have no interest in them being funded. Now, so I know from my own experience that the Saudis put in a considerable amount of effort to try and stop funding going to extremist organizations. They have banned charitable donations and all sorts of things. But it doesn't mean that they can absolutely prevent individuals, whether it's individual Saudis or Kuwaitis or Qataris, they can't prevent individuals finding ways to get money to extremists. But I know from talking to government officials and intelligence sources that actually that's not the big source of funds for people like Daesh and others, although it's a relatively easy target for Hillary Clinton to go after.
But just to bring in Alessio again, just tell me, you know, we've seen some rocky months in the relationship between Washington and Riyadh. And in part, that is down to the fact that, you know, what's happened in the Iranian deal, that the Saudis have felt a bit outflanked. They feel that their kind of narrative hasn't worked in Syria. They feel everything's kind of gone wrong on the diplomatic stage for them. So to hit them again now, as there was an attempt at rebuilding kind of relationships, it's going to be serious, isn't it?
Oh, well, I think there's a big crisis in the US-Saudi relationship anyway. I think the Saudis have lost confidence in the US, which was their traditional ally, so it doesn't help. I think the Saudis in their sober moment will look at this as kind of said in the heat of an election and would wait until... in their eyes, I think they're probably hoping it's President Clinton for more sober reflection, because she will now, through her own briefings of her intelligence services on the level of cooperation in counter-terrorism with the Saudis and others, the extent to which the Saudis are as anxious about terrorist funding as they are.
Let's say it wasn't just the Saudis that got, you know, pulled into this game. The, you know, the Qataris, the Kuwaitis, you know, again, allies of the US. You know, the Kuwaitis are a nation that the US went to war to kind of help liberate. What is she hoping to achieve, do you think, with, you know, bringing them all into the story?
Well, I mean, this is the $1 million question everybody's trying to find an answer to. I think I'd probably go first and foremost with the point that was just raised about the election. How do you distinguish, you know, how you set yourself apart from the other candidates? And so that sort of strong position, trying to point the fingers towards countries that have been traditional allies. But let's face it, both in the WikiLeaks a few years back, as well as in the reports on 9/11, there were allegations of connections, therefore, as feeble as they might appear. So I think in the context of an electoral sort of discussion, debate, confrontation, she certainly comes up as a strong sort of candidate by making this connection. Let's not forget also that when she was Secretary of State, the WikiLeaks documents clearly indicates that she always felt very uncomfortable in the way the Obama administration was downtoning problems in the relationship with the Kuwait, as with Saudi Arabia. So I think there's a story of an opportunity in an electoral context, but also some sort of an unresolved changing dynamics, and certainly a willingness to send a signal that the Democratic candidate is not necessarily entirely at her leisure with the way the current administration is dealing with these relationships.
So William, when you look at, you know how to do diplomacy in the region. I think for outsiders, they get very confused when they see the Qataris, for example, you know, offering to host, you know, an office maybe for the Taliban, seeing to support organisations which the West may feel have connections with terrorism, but we're not purely terrorist organisations, perhaps. How do we read what the Saudis... You say it's quite clear that they don't want to support Al-Qaeda and they don't want to support Daesh. But how do we read what they do want in these situations? Because it does seem mercurial at times, but it's very hard to read for an outsider.
Well, I mean, I think one of the problems is that we ourselves, in the context of Syria, say, have had a difficulty in which opposition we support. We know we are anti-Assad and we're anti-Daesh, but within that, there's quite a big range of people right towards the Al-Qaeda frame and what we would call the moderates. So in one sense, the Qataris have been more comfortable supporting people we would regard at kind of the extreme end of the Islamic opposition, if you like, not quite tipped over to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. So they're more comfortable doing that. I think traditionally the Qataris have sought a diplomatic role for themselves, which has been distinctive from the Saudis. For instance, they were big supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood for a long time. And they've also set out to set themselves up as kind of in between. So they've hosted the Taliban, but the Americans wanted them to host the Taliban because it was the one place they could begin to have a dialogue over Afghanistan. And so they've played that kind of intermediary role quite well as they try to kind of be a player on the stage.
Well, we're going to move on in a moment because you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Sir William Patey and Alessia Patalano. But coming up next, we're going to ask why Donald Trump wants to revoke the Washington Post's press credentials.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I design because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Sir William Patey and Alessio Patalano. Now, Donald Trump has announced that he is revoking the Washington Post's press access at his campaign events, calling the newspaper phony and dishonest. It's not the first time that he's barred media outlets. Politico, The Daily Beast and Huffington Post are on that list too. So, William, not great for somebody who wants to be the President of the United States having an issue with newspapers asking tough questions.
Indeed, and the Wall Street Journal, of all newspapers, one of the most respected newspapers in the United States. I think he's just increasingly turning into Vladimir Putin, his great hero. This is a man who responds to criticism by threatening people. If he doesn't like what newspapers are saying, he wants to shut them down. Mm. He wants to build walls. He's a racist. I mean, it's unbelievable when you look at how he's evolving and how he's running this campaign. The man has all the traits of a dictator. I mean, you can only assume if he was elected, of course, it would test the strength of the American system of the separation of the judiciary and the free press. I mean, it's probably strong enough to withstand Trump, but it's all a bit worrying.
Alessia, the same question. You need somebody who's going to be the leader of America, who believes in press freedom, who believes in scrutiny, who believes that, you know, it may not be comfortable, but at the end of the day, that is the role of the Fourth Estate. And he's very unsure about having them around. He's misogynist to kind of women who ask him tough questions on TV. He barracks people who try to pick him up on any fact. What do you make of this ban?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say as an Italian national is that Trump makes Silvio Berlusconi look like a genuine statesman of the highest order. Having said that, I think that part of the problem is that for someone who wants to portray himself as an icon, as someone that delivers a strong image, it really doesn't know how to adapt to that image if the messages getting back is not something that sort of pleases that image that he wants to project. He doesn't know how to deal with the media. We've seen this. I think it's very troubling. It's absolutely problematic. I think that notwithstanding the attraction that I hear many people have for him in terms of him being the controversial, outspoken, out of the sort of grey political toolbox type of person, these are the type of fundamental, very basic element, the challenge, the possibility to consider him as a genuine candidate for a presidency. Because if you're the president of the United States, you will have to make tough decision. And if you have to make tough decision, you will find yourself, the media, not always agreeing with you. What do you do? Do you ban everybody? So, given the state of the world, it means that with the Trump president, within a matter of 9 months, we won't have any sort of, media press reporter in the White House anymore. Really, is this the type of presidency? I think this is a very serious question. It's a small instance, but that at the same time provides a window into a fundamental problem that might really sort of issue a fundamental challenge, because the way we engage with international politics is also through the media presenting you with different views and leaders responding to them. Shutting them down is no response.
Well, we're going to finish today with Euro 26, the football tournament, and the hooliganism currently overshadowing the supposedly beautiful game. Scenes of rival fans from Russia and England wielding metal bars and hurling beer bottles in street clashes in Marseille, as well as incidents in Nice, Lille and Paris, have turned attention away from events on the pitch at the tournament. Football's governing body, UEFA, has warned that Russia will be thrown out of Euro 2016 if their fans cause any further trouble. So when you look at the violence that's been going on, and it is a new kind of football hooligan. This is a group of people, 150 we believe, kind of mainly kind of at the head of all this violence from on the Russian side, who don't particularly drink, don't do drugs, they are fit and able, and they have kind of trained almost militarily for violence. Do you think the Europeans were just unprepared for what's happening?
Yes, although they shouldn't have been, because we've seen this in the past. We've seen it in Ukraine a little bit, and we've seen it in Russia. I mean, we had that sort of hooliganism in Britain. I remember it in the 70s and the 80s when people just went, gangs of hooligans went for the fight, and they weren't always as fit as these Russians. I mean, the worrying part about this is the way the Russians themselves have reacted. I mean, even in the heyday of English hooliganism, they were condemned by everybody, whereas there you've got the Russian sports minister giving a thumbs up at the stadium, you've got the Russian press saying, right on, lads, you stuck it to those English, and you've got the a member of the Russian football delegation, who is one of the leaders of the ultra fans, handing out tickets. So there is an issue there. I mean, we can all suffer from fans' exuberance in the Germans. It's happened to Germans, it's happened to the Dutch, and it's happened to the English. And I'm Scottish, as you can tell, and I remember the days when we were not the best-behaved fans around Europe. But the problem is how the Russian authorities approach it themselves. That's what differentiates them.
Alessio, what is it at the heart of the, we're talking about the, Russian government officials giving their backing to this?
Well, I think it's part of the hybrid challenges that we're facing. I think your reference to Ukraine, I think it's absolutely spot on. And I think we should think about this. And I must regret it. Someone that as a profession should be sort of academically look at this thing and sort of think about that it could happen. I didn't see this one coming. But if you think about it, all the sanctions and the strangling of the Russians, that has been sort of the pressure on the Russians, is hitting the lower sort of end of the spectrum of the Russian society. And at the political level, the response to this has been, oh, you're suffering. That's because everybody else is ganging up on you. So how would you possibly expect them to respond in a situation like that? I think they also, they created the, some sort of the grassroots feeling for something like that to happen, because it plays to the original hooliganism that we've seen in the 70s and 80s that so sort of worked so hard across Europe to start eradicating. That didn't happen in Russia. It's actually sort of being turned into some sort of a weapon. It's like, you see, if you were feeling sorry for yourself, it's not our fault, it's their fault. So if you go there, bring down to them and give them a response in kind.
Just a few seconds, William. So, William, interestingly, because I presume that the Russians could have stopped these people travelling, they, like most authorities, they would have known who they were. So, again, there is a complicity, isn't there?
All they would have had to do is not give them the tickets. so never mind not taking punitive measures, just don't encourage them.
Well, that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcos Hippie. It was researched by Fernanda Augusto Pacheco and also by Cy Villafuerte. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. A special guest, thank you to my guest. More music is up next. And then at 1900 hours is our design show, Section D, with Henry Rhys Sheridan. We'll have more on the main stories of the day at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening. And goodbye.